Hello, this is Peter Fisher, and I'm bringing you episode 2 of the Fisher Files. And today we're going to talk about buckets and the weekly review. So today we're going to start talking about some of the real aspects to the academic life and what you can do and what I try to do to connect the large things to the small things, the large things being the big things I want to achieve or think I want to achieve or aim for in my life, and the 200 or so little things that I do in the course of each day. And the two topics, I think, are kind of the two central topics, or at least sort of the starting points to discussion of how to get through life a little bit more gracefully. And I should say that a lot of the ideas that I have are inspired by, or even just taken from, a book by David Allen called Getting Things Done. And I'll just mention a little bit about getting things done right now, because it underlies a lot. It's a book on, getting things done, and it's really the only one I've ever read that is at all inspiring and at all well written. David Allen's kind of an interesting character, and he has a consulting company that also helps you with organizational and planning issues, and it's apparently quite successful. I'll put the URL for his website in the program notes, and you can go poke around there. There are some interesting products and flowcharts, and his book, Getting Things Done, which you can buy in the Coop, is really a very nice way to get started with some of the things I'm talking about. I don't want to just repeat everything that's in Getting Things Done. I really want to try to extract from those things the things that I think are really key and important, and focus on how they apply to the academic life or the academic environment. There is also a one-hour sort of PBS infomercial about by David Allen about Getting Things Done that you can download, and it costs like $7 or $8. It's more inspirational than practical, but it's well worth listening to. And I'll put the URL for that in the program notes as well. Let me just also say a little bit about the academic life, because I want to really focus things towards that. Nobody's forced to be an academic. I don't think it's anyone's real plan B, because it's just so different than sort of mainstream commercial life. There's the view that there's less money involved, although I think that really isn't true, and I'll say more about that later on, or if somebody wants to email me about it. I think actually it's probably one of the most well-paying courses you can choose. People tend, obviously, to be pretty highly educated and self-starters and very highly motivated, and that leads a sort of different air to the academic life, particularly around a place like MIT, which, after all, was founded by Puritans who believe that the idle hands are the devil's playground. So MIT has this huge culture of busyness, which does result in some productivity, but there's also just a lot of busyness. And one of the main themes I'm going to have is really emphasizing avoiding busyness in favor of things like reflectiveness and serenity. One of the important things about academic life is having ideas. That's really sort of the raw material. We all walk around each day, and in the course of our years and careers, really the thing we want to do are have really good ideas and bring them to fruition and expand human knowledge and make the world a better place. And this isn't to say that in other professions that people don't have good ideas and put them into practice, but it's kind of our stock and trade. There's not really anything else we make. And when you go to hear someone give a talk, what you're hearing about are their ideas. And when you take a course, what you're hearing about are ideas that have withstood some test and are somehow now what we consider part of knowledge. And what we really want to do, or what I really want to do, a central aim, is to handle ideas better, to get them from just being thoughts either into the wastebasket, because not all ideas are good ones, or bring them to fruition in some way as efficiently as possible. There's this old saying, success is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. I think that really kind of demeans the whole thing. The inspiration is really tremendously important. And the perspiration isn't sweat. It shouldn't be hard to move your ideas out of your mind and through some system that brings them to some point where they're a paper or a talk or discarded. And really the central thing about this podcast, or a central thing about this podcast, is going to really be that. So ideas come from your mind, and I believe that they come from a mind that's as uncluttered as possible. Clutter being the little dialogue that's constantly going on in your brain, and stilling that dialogue as much as possible, I think is a good thing, and allows your brain to do what it really does well, which is think and expand and explore things. So by the clutter, I mean just the crap that's going on in there most of the time, annoying people who you replay little conversations with, and the stupid things you have to remember, like getting a parking sticker for your car so you can park in the right lot, and the petty little annoyances, and perhaps the anger over an interruption. Really getting rid of that junk as quickly as possible, and leaving your mind open to do things that it really does best, I think is key. And one way of doing this is what David Allen calls having buckets, so that when you have some idea or you have some thought where you think, oh, I have to get a parking sticker for my car, that you have a system that takes that thought and allows you to store it somewhere that isn't your brain and keep it there with the confidence that you will act on it in a timely fashion. Now, your brain is pretty smart. It will keep reminding you of whatever it is unless it has real confidence that it is somewhere where it will come back up and get done. So the whole point of this is to develop some system, and there's no one system. You just got to figure it out for yourself, and it's not very hard. But to figure out a system that catches all of this crap that's just rattling around in your brain and brings it back to you in some way so that you get it done. The importance of this has to do with the way your brain works. Your brain is really not good at remembering things in a prioritized fashion. There have been some studies recently in the last year, I think Nature has had a few articles on them, about how you remember things that you're supposed to do. And in these studies, magnetic resonance imaging has been really, really important because it allows neurobiologists to take pictures of your brain and highlight the active areas. And somebody who's remembering some small task or two small tasks or five small tasks does this by forgetting and having the brain remind itself of these tasks over and over in pretty much a continuous way. And you can just see this two different areas of the brain firing back and forth. And the supposition is that's how you remember. You're constantly reinforcing the neurons that have that information stored. The problem is, you know, your brain is doing a lot of other remembering. You know, it's remembering something interesting from a lecture last week, and you know, the time your mother caught you in some act of self-abuse when you were a child, and a whole bunch of other things, and it's just kind of really firing along. And the more you can get that out, the better. I mean, a really specific example, if you've ever had to catch an airplane really early in the morning and had an alarm clock that you don't quite trust, what you find happens is you maybe go to bed at about 10 o'clock, and then you kind of wake up every half hour and look at the clock and then kind of drift back to sleep, because your brain is smart enough to know that it better damn well be getting you up every half hour, because it's not sure your alarm clock is going to. And anyone who's ever been through that knows it's just a crappy experience. So thing number one that you need to figure out is how you're going to catch ideas and little jobs that you need to you know, keep track of, and maybe larger things that you keep thinking about that you need to just get out somewhere. I had an interesting experience last summer. I had kind of this daydream. It was pretty elaborate, and I kind of thought about it a lot. And after a while, it really wasn't very satisfying to think about. It's so stupid, I'm not going to tell you what it is. But one time I was on a bus coming back from Woods Hole, I think, and just kind of in frustration, I had my Trio PDA with me, and with my two thumbs, I just kind of typed in a narrative of the entire daydream. And it was, you know, it wound up being like 10 or 12 pages long, so it was, you know, a lot of two-thumb typing. But the interesting thing is, after that, you know, when I started thinking about the daydream, it kind of be like, oh, wait a minute, I've written that all down. I don't need to think about this anymore, because if I need to think about it, you know, it's all there, you know, in my Trio. Of course, I never have to look at it. But it really got me thinking that there's just a whole bunch of crap in your mind, and you've got to get it out somewhere. So getting it out is just kind of the first step. You need to have a system that brings it back to you. David Allen has a lot of really good suggestions for this. There are a lot of systems that involve, you know, Palm Pilots and PCs and websites and things like that. So you can, you know, if you're a gadget freak, you can really go wild on this stuff. And we'll talk about systems that I think work and systems that don't work later on. But the first thing you really need to do is just start getting in the habit of taking ideas and thoughts and to-dos and daydreams and stuff and writing them down somewhere, putting them somewhere. This can be your phone, a Palm Pilot, a piece of paper, your notebook, anywhere. We'll talk in subsequent weeks about creating a system to take care of all of this stuff, but a good way to start is just putting it somewhere tangible that, and so that you know where it is. What I do is I have the Trio, and Palm Desktop has a to-do list and a calendar. I use iCal. I'm kind of in between things. If I think of something I need to do, I just put it on the to-do list. And if I think of something that's an appointment, I put it on the on my calendar. And if I think of something longer, I make it into a memo. I used to carry the Trio around with me and type stuff into the Trio, but I don't do that anymore. What I do is I get these little Moleskine notebooks, not the thick ones that are about 100 pages long, but there are thinner ones that are maybe 30 pages long, and I just have it in my back pocket. I use the thin ones because the thick ones tear a hole even in my jeans in about 2 weeks. So the thin ones, you know, they kind of curve around my butt when I sit, and, you know, after a while I get this kind of, you know, butt shape to them. And I just get the ones with unruled paper, and whenever I think of something, I just write it down. No matter how stupid it is, how irrelevant, how, I just get it out just as quickly as I can. And then every day or two, take that and type it into the to-do list, the calendar, or the memos. And so I just have this way of, no matter where I am or what I'm doing, getting it into that and then back out. Now, if I'm working on something more elaborate, I have my notebook, and probably all of you have a notebook because it's a pretty basic thing for a scientist to have. And so more elaborate things, when I'm sitting working on something, go into the notebook. So I kind of have these three main buckets, which are the notebook, the little notebook in my pocket, and the computer. I actually have a laptop at home that synchronizes with the computer at work, and everything synchronizes with the Trio. But, you know, I find that kind of only a 10% help. So other buckets I have is, my wife and I keep track of our finances, or at least we try to. So any receipt or anything goes into actually my left hip pocket. The notebook sits in my right hip pocket, and at the end of every day, I just kind of grab everything that's in the left hip pocket, all the receipts and Charlie cards and whatever shit's accumulated during the day, and just drop it into this basket we have at home. And then kind of once a week or every 2 weeks, we go through the basket and record receipts and file things. And that seems to work pretty well. That's kind of all the, you know, all the crap I have coming out of my mind and out of my pockets. And there are just four places where it gets caught. So that's a way to do it. There are lots of other ways to do it. If you have a good way, tell me. David Allen has similar sorts of suggestions. There's also a website, 43folders.com, that has suggestions along these lines. And I'll put this up on the program notes. 43 Folders tends to be pretty techy and nerdy. It's kind of fun. There are a lot of mind hacks there. But the point about, you know, all of these buckets is, you know, it's kind of the front end of an organizational scheme. And there's no really right way to do it. The thing I like about David Allen is he uses the word organic a lot. And these methods and techniques are not things that are going to be static in your life if you start doing them. You'll find better ways to do things, or you'll have, you know, life changes and have to do things in a different way. And the other thing with any organizational scheme is you fall off the wagon sometimes. I mean, I'm kind of just getting back on the wagon now. For the past week, I've just been organizationally kind of a mess, and buckets haven't been catching things very well. And, you know, that's okay. You just got to keep working at it. The second thing I wanted to talk about today, which is the second key element of the idea of getting things out of your brain and into some trustworthy system, is the idea of having a weekly review. The term comes from David Allen. It's a good descriptive term, but I think it's a little bit kind of stuffy. The idea is that once a week you sit down with your system, however you choose to sort things and catch things and make lists, and go through everything. Go through all the pending things on the to-do list, go all through all the things in your notebook and on your calendar from the last week and upcoming week, add items to the to-do list, add items to the calendar, just basically review everything that's going on from beginning to end. So you'll have some set of active projects, and we'll talk about what a project is in a subsequent podcast, but it's actually pretty obvious. And you want to look at each of those projects and see how it's going. See what things need to be added, if more time needs to be given to it. You can go through all the things you're waiting for and add to-do items to remind people who owe you things. There is also a category of things on a list somewhere that you might do. And you might choose to make those into active projects or not. You might choose to make an active project inactive or delete it. And going through your to-do list, you might choose not to do things. And in fact, I'm always very happy when I have something that I just decide not to do. Like, write a thank you note to my mother. You don't need a thank you note. I'm not going to do it. The idea behind the weekly review is that it again reinforces to your brain, that lousy servant, that you are taking care of business, and that the things that you take out of it and put onto a piece of paper or into a Palm Pilot or whatever will get dealt with. This is also a good time to maybe sit back for a minute and think about what your larger goals are and how those are related to the projects in front of you. David Allen has a whole way of talking about this that's kind of nice, that I won't go into here. But trying to specify things more to the academic world, if, for example, you're working in the Center for Theoretical Physics, and you have a new idea for understanding the cancellation in certain supersymmetric processes, the way to trace that idea would be, while walking down the street one day, you have the idea, you write it down in your Moleskine notebook, and then in the weekly review, it would come out of the Moleskine notebook, and you'd look at it, and you'd decide, okay, well, this is important, I want to give it some time, I want to make it a project, and at which case you'd make it a project and start making a list of things that you want to do to bring that project to fruition. And some of those things would go on to your to-do list. And in subsequent weekly reviews, you'd add things to the project, move to-dos over from the project onto the to-do list as other things get completed. And at a certain point, you may say, well, that's not going to work out, in which case you just delete the whole thing. Or it may get to be a publication or a talk, in which case you'll start a new project, which is the actual writing of the publication or the talk. The idea of all of this is that because the little boring daily steps are written down somewhere, they're not burdening your mind, and your brain can actually spend its time really thinking about what the cancellations mean, interesting ways of approaching them, and of course all of those thoughts, if they result in tangible actions, can go into the little notebook and thence into the larger system. So that's kind of the overall scheme. And in subsequent podcasts, I'll talk about the to-do list, or actually lists, because it turns out there are many of them. What a project is, taking care of your calendar, how email fits into all of this, and some of the really fun technology that you can apply to this. But to recap, remember there are two things to start trying to use this week if you're interested in that, and that's set up some buckets, just places where you can catch things. And at the end of the week, sit down for a weekly review where you kind of empty all the buckets and sort things and try to organize things into ways so that you can systematically think about them. And basically free up your mind so that you can have good ideas and not be worried about, you know, remembering to buy toothpaste on the way home, or be irritated by, you know, something that happened. The other thing is that if there is something bothering you, this is a good way to just write it down. If you write it down on a piece of paper, your brain will think, okay, well, I just don't have to remember that, so I can stop thinking about it. And you file the piece of paper away somewhere. And we'll talk about files as well. This week's mind feed is about an article titled Coherent Control of Optical Information with Matter Wave Dynamics, which appears in the current issue of Nature. That's the February 8th. I guess that's not too current. Anyway, it's a very interesting article about some new work that's been done using Bose-Einstein condensates. It's actually got, it's the cover story. It's got the title, A Trick of the Light, Sending Messages with Matter, on the cover, with some hands waving mysteriously over crystals emitting light. If you actually think about this, sending messages with matter really isn't that new. Letters are primarily matter. Anyway, what I found very interesting about this is that it really sort of challenges you to understand deeply what's going on quantum mechanically. I'll just describe the setup quickly. There'll be a link to this article on the program notes. The basic idea is you have a Bose-Einstein condensate. I think in this case it's sodium. Sodium has three levels, a ground state, which is called state one, a state two, which lies just above it with no allowed transition between state one and state two, and then a state three, which lies above both state one and state two, and is accessible to both. So the idea is you form two Bose-Einstein condensates that are spatially separated, and they're sitting in the ground state, state one, and then fire through what's called a coupling beam, which connects state one to state three, and then from the left, for example, fire in a probe beam of light in the opposite direction. The probe beam of light connects, drives some atoms from state one to state three, or some fraction of the condensate from state one to state three. And then the coupling beam drives those atoms down to state two. So you wind up with atoms in state one and atoms in, well, you wind up with part of the condensate in state one and part of the condensate in state two. The atoms that have absorbed the light to get into state two have also absorbed some momentum and actually begin to move. So the next thing you do is you turn off the probe beam, so you just have these two Bose-Einstein condensates sitting there in space, and the atoms in state two which form state to, actually leave one condensate and travel across empty space to the second condensate, at which point you turn the light pulse, the coupling beam, back on. That allows the atoms in state 2 to go back to state 1, and a pulse identical to the one you put in from the left comes out traveling to the right. So what you've done is kind of broken this wave function that describes the Bose-Einstein condensate into two parts, spatially move the atoms comprising one wave function to another identical Bose-Einstein condensate. They're identical up to a phase, and then de-excited it to get the exact same pulse out. So those atoms encode the exact information that's in the incident pulse of light. I'm not sure what the greater meaning of all of this is. It looks to me like just a really cool, great experiment. Of course, quantum computing is mentioned, but you know that really doesn't mean anything because everyone doing condensed matter physics or atomic physics mentions quantum computing. Obviously, it's a very large, non-classical effect. And in the summary, they point to this as an interesting new laboratory to really study extreme quantum mechanical effects. Anyway, I thought that was a very interesting little article, and I recommend that if you think you understand quantum mechanics, it's really worthwhile sitting back and going through this article carefully. There was another article on the News and Brief page, which has a picture of the Bevatron, which is a particle accelerator that I worked at. It was very old, started in 1955. It was at Lawrence Berkeley Labs. And I worked there in, 82, 83. And they're going to tear it down. It's pretty small by today's standards. It fits in a building that's maybe 100, 150 feet across. And, the lab needs the space, so they're going to knock it down. Since it's in Berkeley, of course, the historical commission told them they couldn't. They went to court, and, because it's Berkeley, the university got what it wanted. And so it's going to go. I worked on one of the last experiments there, and I think I might have been the last person to see an antiproton come out of the Bevatron. It's in fact what the Bevatron was built to do. Also in both Science and Nature are extensive coverage of the International Climate Change Conference in that was just held in Paris, I believe. This conference pretty definitively said that the world is heating up and that we're all responsible for it. And this has triggered really quite a bit of news attention, which I think is a good thing. And I suggest, just as a responsible person, you take the time to read these articles and understand exactly what was said and exactly how dire the situation is. It looks like if we all pull together, we can mitigate these problems, but it looks like it's too late to really reverse them, at least in any time soon. Were I younger, this is certainly an area that I'd think about getting involved in. Finally, there's an interesting essay from Evelyn Fox Keller, who is a professor at MIT, about the influx of physicists into complex biology. So there's this whole area of bioinformatics and bioengineering. And as you may know, this is really a growth opportunity for people in physics to move to another field. And physicists bring with them this idea, this reductionist idea that the main part of a scientific endeavor is to find universal fundamental laws, which is fine. That's a good thing to do. But it's a good idea if you're a physicist or a chemist or someone working in the physical sciences that are very reductionist to keep in mind that other sciences have different traditions and different methodologies. And really in biology, in the life sciences, things are sufficiently complicated and different and not as well understood that the methodology of physical sciences is not always appropriate. Biology tends to be very descriptive and have more general rules than really specific universal rules. And it sounds to me like physicists are kind of, not making too many friends. Anyway, it's a good article to read to get the other point of view.
We have a hard time to understand everything. No, wait. Yes. To be suspicious is much too early. To be suspicious is much too early.
So that's it for episode 2. Buckets in the Weekly Review. Next week, I'm going to talk about projects, which are kind of the cement or the glue between the big and the small. As usual, I'd like to thank Sheila Olser-Marston and her husband John Marston and Sean Galinas and Maynard Thompson for providing the disk space and server. And Bonna Newman and Homer Reed at Refs for the encouragement. You can email me from the website or at my email address, fisherp@mit.edu. If there's something you'd like to hear about or some suggestion or you just want to be in touch, please feel free. Contact. Comments of all sorts and questions are more than encouraged. Anyway, until next week, enjoy your work, enjoy your research, and enjoy your life in Cambridge or wherever you are.
A hard time to understand everything. No, wait. Yes. To be suspicious is much too early. To be suspicious is much too early. Wait. Yes. No, wait. Yes. To be suspicious is much too early. No, wait. No, wait. Yes.